You'll be finding your seats. I appreciate the got quiet, so it must be time to start. We are looking at 2 Corinthians chapter 8, working through the grace of God bestowed on the Macedonians. And so we'll get started in just a moment with a word of prayer, and then we'll get back into the text. We're just in the first section still, 2 Corinthians 8, these first seven verses or so. But before we get started, man, thank you, brother. So remember that chapters 8 and 9 in 2 Corinthians are kind of a shifting of gears from our study of the curriculum. We call them a pivot point. We've been talking about one topic, and we're going to go into kind of an application of that. Paul's been exhorting the Corinthians, trying to remind them who he is and who they are, as though they could forget. But when he gets into the second half letter, after chapter 10, he's going to start talking about the false teachers that have come in among them. That's what's made them have this kind of amnesia about the things they learned and the things they saw in Paul. But in the middle, as Paul is so characteristic of doing, and as I love to see the Spirit doing this, not only through Paul, but in other books, even in the Old Testament, as there is the hard reality of what they're facing, there's also the encouragement that comes from the Spirit, comes from God in the midst of the punishment, in the midst of the speaking with tough love toward them. And so these two chapters, Paul is encouraging them by way of reminder about this offering they said they were going to participate in. He may be wondering if they're so backward toward him, if they've completely even forgotten about doing this offering. So he sent Titus and a couple of others along, we'll see them today, to remind them of the offering, to make sure they're still on track spiritually and practically with all the things they said they were going to do. And so we've noticed that Paul's focus is always on God. And we've seen that over and over through Paul's letters. Something that's really should encourage and build us up in our focusing on God. But in chapters 8 and 9 specifically, he starts out, I want to make known to you the grace of God bestowed on the church of Macedonia. That phrase, the grace of God, or just that, the grace, appears 12 or 13 times, depending on your translation, in these two chapters. Paul will exalt the grace of God over and over and over and over again. And we think about giving, that's the word behind giving, charity, charis in Greek. Great, that is grace. And so obviously we want to think about that in here. But what Paul's really thinking about is not the grace that God is giving, but the grace that God receives when others give. Because really it all came from God to begin with. And so then as we distribute that, that's another word that's used, by the way. That's another word that's based in the word grace. Distribute. Share. That, when we distribute that, God's the one who gets glorified. And so Paul sees that. And so we started talking about the Macedonians and how God showed grace on them. And we started out saying, they didn't look like a church that we would say had been touched by the grace of God. What did we look at about them that was so ungraceful looking?
Poverty.
They have deep poverty. How is that the grace of God? We think, oh, well, grace of God means people are rich. But here they have, they're destitute is what the word means. It's deep poverty. What else?
That's what brought my thinking to what would they have given?
Yeah.
They didn't have money. And we were talking earlier this morning about, can you imagine transporting food or whatever they gave to these stinky Christians?
Yeah, whatever they could come up with to send as an offering, somebody had to take that. Yeah, so that's why Paul's so concerned about this. He says in 2 Corinthians 11, he was in danger carrying all this stuff. People would see this, and then, you know, caravans would be attacked. But yeah, there is a need to be able to transport
this. There would be a lot of other brethren involved if you were trying to take care of a whole group of people in another area.
And as he'll point out, practically, he wants brethren from the congregations that are giving to travel with the gift. So then they'll know the gift came by free will from that group even. So this is a way for brethren to get to know each other, to be involved in this. So, but we saw that their deep poverty, there was something else that doesn't look like it's much grace.
Their
great trial of affliction. All right, you guys are on the same page there. It's the same verse. You're in verse 2. So this great trial of affliction. And we looked last time that Paul said in Philippians that it's been granted not only to know Christ, but to suffer for him. That's been grace to us, to suffer for Christ. And so often we think of that as a disgrace, but it's a grace. And so the Macedonians have received this grace of God, and in it, what we see as the grace is, even though they're in great trial of affliction, what's the expression they give?
I heard somebody say
joy. They're joyful in the midst of this great trial of affliction because they're not looking at the affliction. They're looking at the reward. And so The grace really is the affliction built in them, this perseverance and this faith that's tested toward joy. John?
Read my version, it almost reads to me more like he's saying that, he's not saying that they receive grace because of it, he's saying that through them, grace can be taught.
Yes, I think that's the point. But the point I'm trying to make is when we look at a situation like, well, I'm in affliction, we can't see God's grace. And we don't allow God's grace then to build up in us or to come out from us because we're so worried about the affliction. But it was the affliction that built God's grace in them and helped them then with great joy to see others who were afflicted and say, we can help them. Isn't that amazing? That's how Paul really started 2 Corinthians. We learn from our trials how to help others when they're in trials. That's what he's showing, the example of Macedonians here.
You're
very expressive. I'm thinking you got something you want to add.
I never have anything worthwhile to say, sure. So I'll just lather on. Both personally as individuals, as we suffer, we should be more together than we are. And as the Lord's church in His place, we should be more giving than we are.
Yeah. We tend to think of hoarding as what comforts us in affliction. What really comforts us in affliction is giving, comforting others. And then we share the comfort. Isn't that an amazing thing? That's thinking spiritually and not carnally. That's what we're talking about in our prayer service. That's the difference. And so, Paul says they had great joy in their affliction, and then they're in this deep poverty, but did what? Verses 2 and 3. This is still a reminder of what we talked about last week.
These are good things to think about.
So they have nothing, yet they are so rich they can abound in just giving and liberality. So, that again is the grace of God. The grace of God is that they had something to give that people couldn't see. And verse 3 says they gave what? Or how? Well, yes, and beyond. So they understood the principle that it's according to ability, and they said, that's not enough. We don't have enough according to our abilities, let's do more. So they just built some more ability. And we talked about how that would be possible. We see Barnabas do that in Acts chapter 4. You know, he wanted to be able to participate, but, you know, he's got these lands back in Cyprus, perhaps, that he's going to have to sell. Okay, we'll sell. And then he can contribute to the needy saints in Jerusalem so they can continue to grow.
If you told the story about a family that did without me, you wonder if these people didn't shortchange themselves from the things that they really needed on a daily basis to help somebody else.
Think about that, the idea of a sacrifice. We think a sacrifice is giving whatever was left over. Oh, I could use that for a vacation. Or I could use that for... That's not a sacrifice. That's what was left over. A sacrifice is saying, I could really use this. They can use it more. And so he has. That's a sacrifice. And that's the kind of giving that we're talking about here. That's probably Christ's example. And then we'll see that in just a moment when we get to verse 9.
Good. If I was a stranger here, what am I looking for? It's like the world is thinking about, you know, the church is supposed to do with everybody.
Yeah.
Or the church is supposed to deal with their own kind. And this is what I'm not hearing. They were given to other Christians, not.
Now, this is not a social work for the city of Corinth.
And this, like I said, I'm a stranger. I don't know nothing. This is what I'm hearing. It's the church is giving above their means to the poor. And that is why we got the problem today. Everybody coming through the door and says, I need help.
Yeah.
And they've been taught that churches give.
Two things about that. First is, in chapter 8, we're kind of looking at individual responsibility. It is going to become church responsibility. But he's talking about how these individuals who make up the church reacted. We get to chapter 9, though. I'm hoping if you're visiting, you stick around and you come back and study chapter 9 with us. It's very patent in the beginning of chapter 9. This is a ministering to the saints. And I'll bring that point out a lot. But I appreciate what you're saying. If somebody were just to walk in, in fact, we had a couple that did that not too long ago, and I was preaching about having the giving heart, and they said, well, we were really encouraged by your lesson. Can you give us some money? And so they basically said, you said this is what you're going to do. Will you do it? But we helped them for a bit, and then they decided they weren't coming back anymore. But they misunderstood the point. But God does say we should be giving, even to those who are outside. It's not a work of the church, though. That's a work of individuals. So yeah, I appreciate that, and I think chapter 9 will make that distinction. Paul's setting them up. They know this already. This is an internal letter. But for those who might happen to stumble in, yeah, we need to be careful about how we approach these kind of subjects. But we need to have the right heart behind this and the right motivation as the Corinthians did. So they were able, as the Macedonians did here, they were able to give beyond their ability. Now remember, Paul's setting up the Corinthians to encourage them. You better be giving. The Corinthians are rich. You better be giving. The Macedonians gave beyond their ability. And not only that, they begged us to participate in this. So let's start with the reading again. We made it up to about verse 3 last time. Why don't we just read the whole section again, verses 1 through 7, whoever would like to take that reading, and we'll pick up with our study at verse 4. Who'll read that for us? Thank you, Noel.
Moreover, brethren, we make known to you the grace of God bestowed on the churches of Macedonia, that in a great trial of affliction, the abundance of their joy and their deep poverty abounded in the riches of their liberality. For I bear witness that according to their ability, yes, and beyond their ability, they were freely, willing, imploring us with much urgency that we would receive the gift and the fellowship of the ministering in the sexes. And not only as we had hoped, but they first gave themselves to the Lord, then to us by the will of God. So we urge Titus that as he had begun, so as he will also complete his grace in you as well. But as you abound in everything in faith and speech and knowledge, in all diligence, and in your love for us, since you are
all right, so who is it that Paul says compelled them, these Macedonians, in their poverty and their trial, to participate in this? I mean, how mean can we be? We go ask the poorest and the most persecuted people in all of Christendom at this time. We go ask them to put in all this money for the saints because there happened to be a famine in Jerusalem or whatever the cause was here. We're not really told the cause this time. They beg to help. Can you understand how that works? Now, we're going to talk about this a little bit later, but so often Jesus is accused of being a socialist or a communist because they had to pool all their money, everybody had the same pay. But in communism and socialism, there is an upward forcing of you to give. You must give and you have not. That's not what we see here. This is the have not saying, we got a lot. Look how gracious God's been. Let's give to these other people. They made the decision. We'll talk about that a little more later on. But they made this decision, and there's a reason why. They didn't see this as just a gift. I mean, if you've got some leftover, you might say, let me give a gift to somebody. Or if you can scrape together something, you might say, let me give a gift to somebody. And that would be an expression of your heart toward that person, of your love for them. But this is more than that. Rather than just being a gift, what do they see this? A couple of things you might say. Fellowship of the ministry. Well, that's a fancy way to say that. You got another reading. I love the way what that says. Is there somebody's got an easier reading of that?
New American Standard, English Standard, or something might say a little bit.
Favor of participation.
The favor of participation. That's more looking at the Macedonians' side. That's an interesting translation of that. The fellowship of this ministry. What is a ministry? Let's work backwards there. It means a service. So the Macedonians are saying, it's not just that we want to give somebody a nice little present and say, we appreciate you. We want to serve. They have the heart of a servant.
And in today's times, that ministry means it's a work of the church.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have somebody overseeing this, and we're going to carry it out.
Yeah, here's a way we can funnel some money. That is not the idea. The word means servants. So they want to be involved in serving somebody else. Well, they don't live in Jerusalem. How are they going to serve somebody in Jerusalem? Well, here's a way. And so they said, Paul, you're going to go there, aren't you? Take this with you. Please help these needy saints. We can do something. We've got some. We can do it. And then the other word that comes, the favor or the fellowship. That's the Greek word koinonia. That's the word that's been used since Acts chapter 2 about they're all coming together and they're spending their time together. Well, think about what that says about the hearts of these Macedonians. They understand that though they're a local congregation, they're one church, they're one body with the saints, no matter where they are. They're all suffering the same affliction of persecution because they're all serving the same Lord who was persecuted.
And they're all needing to work together and build each other up. So they want this fellowship. They want to show that they're brothers and sisters with these Jewish saints. Now that's a big deal. Paul talks about that in Rome, in Roman letters in chapter 15. He's kind of afraid that this mostly Gentile money is going to get to Jerusalem. They're going to say, we can't accept that. And so this is a watershed moment for the early church, that the Jews in their need are going to accept the gift that comes from mostly Gentile brethren. They're going to say, yes, that's an acceptable and a holy gift before God. That's a big deal. And Paul's concerned about that. He doesn't mention that here in this letter very much, but that is a concern of his. But can you see the love these brethren say? We want to show them that we're brothers. We want to serve them as brothers. So with that attitude, when it's time to give, they just give. When someone comes and says, you need to give them a present. Sorry, go ahead, Jerry.
That could be a greater motive.
Absolutely, that's a greater motive. When we understand that, when we're thinking about our brethren suffering over in Mozambique, or wherever they may be, when we understand that, then we think, well, what can I do to serve? When we think, well, I wish I had a little extra so I could give them a gift and show them my appreciation. That's not the same motivation. John?
Yeah, that's why I've never liked it. They all matter. I've never personally liked that idea. It's like they're not saying we need to follow up to their minds. These are Jews over there. They've never liked this person. Like, if we save our lives, we come over before Christ. We're obviously talking. But they're saying, no, let's help these other people.
I appreciate what you're saying, and I agree with you in principle. The only caveat I would throw out there is that you have to take into account local culture. Because Americans have done a lot of damage going over the $50 bill and giving that away when that's 2 years' salary for someone. And they've built up perceived need, if you will, based on money. So there may be other ways to help than just throwing money at something.
How is it not going to money in the gospel?
Great, I appreciate that as well. Yeah, certainly the gospel is the same. But sometimes the way we go about gospeling, we end up creating little Americas and other places, and that's not helpful at all. Yes.
What I see is two types of understanding, where the gospel came to the Jews first, and you think that they would have an understanding of the new system that they should be under. And what they didn't, they thought it was for them exclusively. When the gospel went to the Gentiles, they took it as it was for salvation, and everybody was a part of it, so they were willing to help out the Jews, where the Jews said, I don't want nothing from the Gentiles. Now, how did they get that corrupt thinking from the gospel in the beginning? You know, the Bible lays down what Peter and the other apostles talked to them, and their response, but then we find later on in the Bible other things about their response, which was bringing in the baggage. That,
yeah.
You know, the new system was for everybody, but they still believe it was for them. And we find that same thing in this world today, this misunderstanding of the gospel, you know, who can and who can't. If you go through history of the world, across America, as if it's religion, it was, the religion was, say, technically, and it was white man's religion. That's why a lot of blacks do not like religion. You have to break it down to them because they said it was the white man that forced their religion on slaves. Now, slaves or people have a long memory.
Yeah.
And it goes from generation to generation. And so instead of trying to explain the gospel is for all, we can't help what people did. But God sent his son to die for everybody. And that's what we're looking at. And so, and I also believe that was the reason why Muslims, they caught on from the true things of the Bible, because that part of reason is that Christianity ain't for me. It doesn't show me that. Well, I'm sorry that you think that way, but in the end, everybody's got to die that does not follow.
Yeah, there's only one way.
Yeah. And so we have to, when we talk to people, we have to try to look at all points of view, and when somebody is not heard it, that, you know, this is not my religion, this is the right way. And so you have to understand that and try to break it down to say, no, it's God.
Yeah. Certainly, biblically, we have lots of examples of starting where people are and bringing them from that point to the knowledge of God. You know, Philip did with the eunuch. We see that in lots of other places. Tom?
Well, I appreciate your point. I don't know that I really quite ever thought of it that way. I knew that Gentiles were similar. I didn't really think of Gentiles as a love. Just because of the culture we live in, Christians sending these Christians to the world, I think, more appropriate. When you said that it was Gentiles, Christians, and then Jews.
Especially the Macedonians, generally foreign, they were pretty good synagogues.
Because, I mean, that would be, on the receiving side, maybe tough, you know, because they're supposed to attend, yeah, I think they're supposed to be chosen then and made that promise.
And what we see, I mean, take a second, John. What we see in all the things that Cooker's pointing out, you're pointing out here, this was never the intent of God's work. This was perversion by the point by men. When God told them to keep themselves unstained from the things the Gentiles stained themselves with, it wasn't the people themselves, it was what they were doing that they didn't need to participate in. But they saw that as, let's just blanket all these people as unsafe to be around or unsanitary or whatever it was, unclean. And so that became an issue that these are dogs and only us. Well, that's never what God's plan, that they were supposed to convert them. That was part of the plan from early. John?
Just a little thought. I don't know if it is. You know, it's probably for them, kind of like us, somewhere there in the incarnation, generally, on light and conflict. Jews looked at Gentiles as a dog, and people below them, historically, and culturally. So, you know, it'd be like, let's say, us and Jews. And they're saying, they're people. That's a stigma that is happening.
Yeah.
We shut down the Christ, but yeah, that cultural.
Yeah. Certainly, if they're converted in Christ, then they're no longer Muslims anyway. But I understand what you're trying to say, and we do have that kind of a cultural prejudice, perhaps. If we're looking at God, that doesn't happen. But then we're looking at God and seeing souls that God sees, that shouldn't happen. When we look at people first, that happens, then we pick and choose. This person will, this person won't accept the gospel.
We need to start with God, and that's what Paul's doing here as he extols the grace of God all through this. The Macedonians are looking at God. Will those in Jerusalem look at him first? Paul says they begged to be able to give. They saw this as participation, as fellowship, as a service, as actually serving these brethren. So why were they able to give themselves so readily in all this? What was behind all of this? This is really what we're getting to, verse 5.
Verse 5 says, they gave of themselves. And that's a passage that really stands out to me this time today. If you're going to work for the Lord, you got to give of yourself. If you don't give of yourself, you ain't going to be worth nothing.
Absolutely. And you give of yourself to whom? To God first, and then to others. And that is a problem that the Spiritist movement, how big it is here in the United States, and in Brazil, it's like the second largest church behind the Catholic, the Spiritism. And they believe in charity. Charity will get you into heaven. Giving. And so they focus on people first. What can I do as a service? How can I earn my way into heaven by doing all these great works? And then, I deserve it now. It's got to get me into heaven. That's a terrible thing. And it makes us look at people first. We should always look at God first and give ourselves to God first. In fact, we can't truly serve another person properly unless we're serving God properly. Think about that in marriages. We're going to be selfish in our marriages unless God is the focus. And with our children, we're not going to raise our children properly unless God is our first focus. Because we're going to think, what does the world want from my children? And raise them for the world. We're going to raise them for God first. And then with our brethren, unless we're thinking of God first, it's so easy to get upset with somebody who doesn't think the way I do or says it in a harsher way than I would. And so that just must not be really serving God. Well, no, that's a personal thing. Again,
give themselves to God first. Then they were able to just readily give themselves to whatever service God said they needed to be performed. That's what holds us back so often. We look at different services and say, I can give myself to that. I'd love to do that. What about all these other things that God says we ought to be doing? Well, who are you looking at? This service and how comfortable that is to me, or who it is that I'm going to provide this service to that I really like. What about all these other things? You got to really consider
the practical application of putting ourselves in God's service first, and that'll facilitate all the rest. Yeah, Roger.
So where did they get this idea that they need to take up this collection for the saints in Judea? For God. That's not something they just came up with. Something they came up with as brethren and servants to somebody else. This is the way we can serve. And so Paul is not only sanctioning that, when they asked about it in the first Corinthian letter, when the Achaeans decided they want to be involved too, they said, well, how do we do it? He said, do like the Galatians, like I told them to do with their offerings. And they're not even involved in this particular offering. If you read Romans 15, it's the Macedonians and Achaeans that are sending this money. It's not the Galatians. But it's the same pattern. And it's a pattern that's been building since Acts chapter 4, where you centralize the money at the elders' or the apostles' feet, and congregations then send individually to this need. Cookie, you got another comment?
Yeah, and verse 5, the last chapter, verse 5, by the will of God, what needs to be done, and what we need to do, and thinking about myself, and always saying to somebody, say, behind the seat of the heart,
Lord willing.
Now, I hope I'm using it correctly, knowing that I may not be it.
Yeah.
But there's more to the Lord's will than just saying that.
That's right.
Like Jesus said in Matthew 7, you're not doing things according to the Lord's will. So we need to know what the will of God is so we can be practicing. And if we never get into the Bible to see what He wants, we're just using that word in vain.
Yeah.
Because we're not doing, and just like in Paul's prayer, the Lord's will for Christians is to be wherever you say you got to be on the Lord. That's everywhere. To serve God.
Mm-hmm.
But we do it like, well, I can get there to this service. Or the world is saying you're so big that you go to whatever service you want to go to. You know? And so, I don't believe that's the Lord's will. That's how it was set up. Because you see, the Old Testament, they had to do all day long what God said to them. But yet, still in the free world here, we pick and choose what God's will. And then we get in trouble.
Christ has freed us from the law. Peter said the burden that not them nor their fathers could bear. Freed us from the law for freedom to serve, but it doesn't mean we just do whatever we want. We're not freed from the restrictions that Christ puts on us or the burdens that He puts on us. We've been chosen not only to believe in Him, but to suffer with Him, the Philippians said. And so the Macedonians have learned that. The Corinthians need to learn that. And so this is a good lesson for them. And so Paul was encouraged by the Macedonians, and so he sent Titus to help the Corinthian brethren, verse 6. What was his desire in doing so?
To give the grace to the Corinthians.
Yeah. And I love the language he uses here. Titus had begun in the grace of God going to them. Now, not certain that Titus had been there and started them with this, that he's now going to help them. They had begun in the grace of God to work on this offering. And so the two of them had started something. Is it going to be completed? It needs to be complete. The Macedonians didn't just have this great idea. They involved themselves and urgently and deeply involved themselves. But look at verse 7. I love the exhortation here. And there's a word that's repeated here, not just in this verse, but it's repeated as a theme in this section. What does he exhort them to do? Since you abound in everything, it's the first letter, he says, they abounded in all spiritual gifts and all knowledge. He thought it was kind of tongue-in-cheek when he said that. They didn't know as much they thought they did. They abound in all this wisdom. They abound in everything. But
mean, really, he's talking about here the riches that they have. They abound in that. So see that you abound in this grace also. Now, once you go back to verse 1 or 2,
something was abounding up there. There's really two things abounding there.
And it's the same kind of two that he's asking the Corinthians to abound in. Yeah. Or really abundant poverty in the one case. The Corinthians are on the opposite end of that. The Macedonians in abundant poverty gain with abundant liberality or abundant joy. The Corinthians are abounding in all things. See that you abound in this grace. Isn't that beautiful how he does that? Comes full circle.
And earlier we had read, because they did seem to be abounding in their
grace. Yes. So he actually picked up on that cue when he started talking about this from the end of chapter 7. Since I see that you are abounding, thank you. That's where the word first started being used. They have been abundant in their repentance.
And he said, since you've done that, then I have confidence that you'll do the rest. And that's why he sent Titus. And we'll see that in the next part of this text here. But thank you for bringing us back to that point. So yes, Paul has sent Titus. He's certain that the Corinthians are on the right track now.
And so make sure they get this done. So we'll see the concern he had then in the next section.
Other comments before we move on to verses 8 and following. Quick. Then Tom.
We short sell that word so much how we use it in our society. Because excel means you're above and beyond everything else around. That's what he's saying. You go beyond. Like the Macedonian brethren did. Beyond their ability. They excelled in their giving because they had a top they could look at and said, we can do better. And what we do is we think it's excellent if we're maintaining the status quo. Look how excellent we are, just like all these other excellent people are. No. You're excelling, you've gone beyond. Tom, go. There's a burden in that lesson.
Yeah, there is no idea of what the problem is.
Roger was talking yesterday for a short while, talking about some people with signs I've asked him for handouts. It says he's talking about just giving them a job application because there's no reason you shouldn't be working if you're able-bodied at all. Everybody's offering work. I mean, you put on the street, there's 8 jobs. I was out with y'all met Jared that I used to work with at Kohl's for a while. I was out with him one day and he was talking about how he doesn't have any money. I said, why don't you go apply for a job? I said, you go walk into Walmart today and get a job. And he felt so guilty, he walked into Walmart and got a job that day. I mean, it was that easy. I said, I didn't really think it would really happen that quickly. It was that quick. So, yeah,
there's no reason to be lamenting that it's so bad here. It's because you've made it bad. You've become a victim. That's our society. Go out and work for it. And then put that to good use. But most of us here, we're sitting on a gold mine and think we're impoverished. We just need to make sure we're focused where we need to be focused.
That's the closest thing I think we could ever equate to standing in that what happened here would be if the great United States fell. We were living in poverty that saved China for Christ. They were the reason we fell. What would we do if those churches there did that?
Wouldn't be the Chinese Christian be the reason we fell, but yeah, but I can understand the bitterness. But certainly, what about the greatness? If God has preserved, with a remnant in China to help those now in the rest of the world who are suffering, what a blessing that would be. Now, we're projecting a lot of possibilities here. Cook, you guys.
That thought pattern is out of here. What I'm trying to tell people is that God tells the people what to do. If we can concentrate on that, what we're supposed to do to keep ourselves pure, then we're going to have problems with some of the other stuff. And what I ask you for, suppose Hitler, before he revived, the gospel was presented to him and he obeyed it and then he died. God said, welcome. All the people in the world that he did things to still hate him. And they don't know whether he did or not. But the thing is, if you're going to say, I am for God, you got to do what God says. You got to let go of the hate. Hate is a powerful thing. And when we look at this world at large, what people do to people, we want to hate them. But God says, no. He says, treat them as, don't hate your enemy, on and on and on and on. But up here, we just can't get rid of them. And like you said, I hate those people for they ain't sending me money to survive, but I don't want their money.
Yeah.
That's dumb. You know, but that's the way we are, because we feel it's me that you're messing over. And even though if you say, I am a Christian, you're not, because Christianity says you don't love.
Yeah, it's what you do, it's not what you say that makes you a Christian. Yeah.
You know, you do what God says, and because when we first started going out to the flea market, and I used to see all these people with tattoos all over them, and that thought first came, but then I had to knock it down and say, that's a soul.
Amen.
You know, just because their tattoos are up and down, that is a soul. And I need to try to get to that soul, not what they look like.
Yeah.
And when we don't do that, we're not doing our job. You know, we're making the people work. They're not going to hear. How do you know? You know, there's one guy there that works on the, he's a seamstress. And, you know, the jackets with all the stuff on it. Me and him have a pretty good relationship, and as it goes, then I will try to approach, you know, the Bible. But you got to get to know people first before you jump out there and start condemning them for what they're doing or not doing or whatever. It's one of these things that we need to learn is I have to know them, they have to know me.
Yeah, a relationship certainly gives us a base to work from. Sometimes we don't have time to build a relationship. We just got to give them the gospel. But when we have that opportunity, certainly we have something to work from. We gain credibility. They see what kind of life we're living before the Lord. All those things make a difference. Paul certainly is working from a relationship with the Corinthians. So these things he's laying out before them, they should be ready to hear, certainly if they say they're Christians. Let's move on through to verses 8 through 15. We've got a few minutes left. Sam, would you mind take that reading for us, 8 through 15? Thanks, sir.
I speak not by commandment, but I am testifying the sincerity of your love by the diligence of others. For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ. And though he was rich, yet for your sakes he became poor, that you through his poverty might become rich. And in this I give advice, it is to your advantage not only to be doing what you began and were desiring to do a year ago, but now you must complete the doing of it. That as there was a readiness to desire it, so there also may be a completion of what you have. For if there is first a willing mind, it is accepted according to what one has, and not according to what he does not have. For I do not mean that others should be eased and you burdened, but by inequality, that now at this time your abundance may supply their lack, and that their abundance may supply your lack, that there may be equality. As it is written, he who gathered much had nothing left over it, but he who gathered little had no lack.
All right, so Paul says very clearly here, this is not a commandment. Well, that's not exactly what he said. He said, I do not speak by commandment. Does that mean that this is just a suggestion then? That Christians taking up a collection is just a suggestion? Or a convention for this momentary need? What does that mean?
That
People try to say this means there is no command. Some may not be willing, for sure. So God's not forcing them in what sense? It, I mean, is this a commandment from God that they need to take up an offering? He's testing their sincerity by what others willfully did. But does that mean this is not a commandment then? This is just, they did this, so why don't you do it? How can we answer that if someone says there's no commandment to take up an offering? First Corinthians 16, written in the same church, said, let each one of you do as I ordered the churches of Galatia to do. It's the same one he was talking about. Absolutely. And so was the other. Yeah. So he'd rather not command, he'd rather say, don't y'all want to be involved in this service? Isn't that a much better way to do things? Think about when you can convince your children to do what's right and not have to beat them into doing what's right or command them to do what's right. Isn't that a much better thing? Don't they grow from that? Don't we grow from that? So Paul's encouraging their growth. Doesn't mean it's not a commandment. This is one of the coolest things about the commandment to give, is that it's mandatory yet voluntary. It is an obligatory command that we give. But the amount is left up to our heart. He'll talk about that a lot more in chapter 9. But he's setting them up for this idea. You know, I could command you, tell Philemon, we'll look at Philemon today, we're really in our sermon. I could command you to do this. But isn't it better when I just appeal to you and then you make the decision how much you want to get done?
It is that true of everything. You know, it's like how much it works.
Again, God freed us from the law. What the Jews did with the law is, well, God commanded 10%. So how much did they give? 10%. So there were some who gave more because, as Jesus was looking at the rich Pharisees, they had a bunch left over. Some gave more because as he looked at that rich widow, or the poor widow, she was rich in spirit, she gave everything she had. He gave a lot more than those Pharisees did. Huh?
I'm sitting there thinking of men's business. If you ever present, and as long as it's not doctrinal, if you try to, something outside of that matter, present in a demanding way, that we need to do something, it's not going to happen. But if you try to present it in such a way that you need to do something, it's scary. All of things pretty convincing about something we learn.
Absolutely. And think about the way he's already set all this up. The Macedonians perceived a need among their brethren and they desired to serve. Now, Paul didn't say, you must do this. They said, please, can we do this? He's shown that little picture and then he goes to the Corinthians and says, I want to command you. Yeah. Don't you feel this need? Don't you feel the desire to serve? Don't you want to participate? And so he just encourages them so that it becomes their own idea. In fact, it looks like from the text, it was their own idea. They were eager a year ago to begin this. The way it's written, it sounds like they began the concept. The Macedonians, when they found out, begged to be a part of it. And so he allowed them to be a part of it as well. But it looks like the idea may have come from the Achaeans. And now he's concerned that they're not even completing the grace that was given them to come up with this idea. All right, our time is up for today. Appreciate very much your comments. I think this is helpful for us to dig in to the motives behind all this, because I think it'll help our giving when we understand what it really is. And certainly it'll glorify God, which was Paul's aim and should be our aim with all these things here. Lord willing, in about 10 minutes, we'll begin our worship service. If you need to take a break, please do so now.